You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
Well, today's podcast is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain management made simple. It is the easiest and quickest way to buy a domain name. If you've ever registered a domain, you know that companies just try to upsell you with stuff you don't need or that should be included in the domain. Hover is honest. It never tries to upsell you at checkout. Everything the other guys extra charge for is included in the cost of your domain, like Whois privacy and domain forwarding. And plus, Hover has the best customer support in the industry. They have a no-hold phone policy. That means if you run into a problem, you call Hover and a real live human being answers the phone, ladies and gentlemen. I actually get excited. It's just so rare, right? So basically, it takes the hassle out of getting a domain. That is what they are selling. You just type in a few keywords you want in the search box, and it'll tell you what's available. And the cool thing is they specialize in .net. So a lot of times you want something in .com or .org. It's not available. Try .net. That is their specialty. And Hover has valet transfers. What does that mean? Well, if you've got a domain somewhere else, they'll take care of the whole process of moving the domain to Hover for you. All right. So they specialize in .NET and they now offer Google Apps. You can get Gmail, Calendar, Drive, Docs, the whole package. You got 25 gigabytes of storage. And, you know, Google's a huge company. Let's be honest. Hard to get a hold of a real person, I'm sure. But Hover has a human being that specializes in Google Apps. So if you got a business, you got a family, you got a group, you want the ability to share all kinds of stuff with, try Hover.com. See how it works. They'll give you a 30-day free trial with the Google Apps as well. So, you know, see what you think. And the best part, guess what? If you go to Hover.com/Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, well, that's a promo code that gets you 10% off a new domain name. Oh, man, the power I have to get you 10% off. Thank you, Hover. There are two books that I've said this about. The Merchants of Doubt, which is a great book that we had the authors on, and now your book. I've been talking about, I have a podcast on Fox called The Fighter and the Kid, mm-hmm. and I've been talking about, basically, you were the theme of it. So it's really a fascinating thing. The book is kind of gutsy, too. I mean, I know that the issue of race, I've heard these debates before. And whenever you start talking about fast twitch muscle and you start talking about, you know, length of thigh and where the belly
Achilles
button is
and
who's good at swimming,
yeah.
It's all these stereotypes. Yeah. But what you do so well in the book is to essentially break down the genetics. You have to have a certain kind of hardware. Yeah, we're already starting. Oh, okay. Tantra goes, are we starting? I go, oh, dude, we just start rolling, bro.
See, Brian just gets so excited that he's into it. He didn't even introduce the show. He's just like...
We have David Epstein, the author of The Sports Gene, on Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. I think that's the subtext. But talk a little bit about... I know you wrote for Sports Illustrated. Talk a little bit about how you got involved in writing this book.
That's a great question. It really comes very much out of my own experience as an athlete and a sports fan. I can kind of tie it really to a couple of influential events in my life, the first of which was growing up outside of Chicago in a town that had kind of a mini Jamaican diaspora in the 1970s and 80s.
Yeah. All of a sudden you're like, why am I so slow?
Yeah. My high school track team, we won 24 straight conference titles, and it was a popular sport at my high school because of all the Jamaicans. And so when I was, 15 and learned that that's an island of 2.7 million people,
that's crazy.
What's going on here, Yeah. And then I move up a little longer distance to run in college, and now I'm running against Kenyan athletes, and you have a lot of downtime at the track meets, and starting to learn that not only are they Kenyan athletes, but from one minority tribe, that has about the population of Costa Rica, that all these guys are from, and I'm saying again, boy, what's going on there? At the same time, I'm training with a group of five guys, and we're getting more different, not more the same, while we're training, and I just started to sort of lodge these questions in my brain, not even thinking of them as sort of genetic questions until the event I write about in the book where one of my former Jamaicans that I had trained with actually dropped dead after a race from a genetic condition. And I started wanting to find out what happened to him and started reading about genetics. And so it sort of started to coalesce in my head that I had all these questions about genetics and health and disease and athleticism.
Well, and a lot of things that we often talk on this podcast about cross-pollination, and that's the thing, the mixture of being an athlete and a sports fan and also having a real science background yourself. That's what makes this book possible. Like, there are plenty of people who are sports fans and plenty of people who are scientists, and they don't write
but
a book this good.
But now David Epstein.
That's right.
David Epstein, ex-track athlete. Ex-track athlete. Not quite Olympic level, but track athlete.
Good, good.
Thanks to his Ashkenazi roots.
I peaked at, I peaked at 2003 U.S. Indoor Nationals I ran at, and then, of course...
That's impressive, dude. That's very impressive, actually.
Unless you had seen how in the prelims I got passed, like I was standing still, and it would look a lot less impressive than it sounds. And that's when I decided I was going to go ahead and go to grad school.
That's so funny, man. That's so great. I watch it a lot of times with boxing. Your style is dictated by just your physical ability to move. And, you know, if you're just a ball of fast twitch muscle, your style is going to be very different. Roy Jones Jr.'s style is going to be a lot different than, you know, certain other boxers, you know, and you just got to tailor your style to that. But you can be a very effective boxer. It all depends on the sport. I mean, you know, I am not. My Irish, Italian, and I believe probably the Italian probably came from Spain. They were probably Jews. They came over and pretended to be Italian. Whatever that gene stock is, I'm not winning any 100-meter dashes, which really annoys me. But anyway.
That's why I always think it's funny that some of these companies are now, you know, they'll sell these tests for the ACTN3 gene, which codes for a protein found only in fast-twitch muscle fibers. Yeah. You know, and if you don't have the so-called right version for sprinting, like, you're just not going to be in the Olympic 100-meter final. But that only rules out 1 billion of 7 billion people on Earth. And I can pretty much guarantee you all of those 1 billion people already know that they're not going to be in the Olympic 100-meter final. So they don't need that gene.
Yeah.
I actually think it's a really good thing because when we start having an honest discussion about genetics, what I think we'll do is save a lot of people a lot of time.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know this stuff, obviously, until I researched and reported on it. And there were a lot of counterintuitive findings for me. And so when I sort of started... basically listing my questions, because this book sort of, I guess the secret behind this book is that it's like my dozen deepest questions about athleticism that I got somebody else to like pay for the travel that so I could go investigate. And so I started it with this experience I had just as a sports fan, where back in 2004 I was watching Jenny Finch, the great softball pitcher, pitch to some of the best major league hitters in history, and wondering why she, you know, they couldn't even hit a foul ball off her. And then, you know, I'm sort of doing like rough calculations to figure out, well, is it because she's standing closer, even though she's pitching slower, is the ball coming faster? That wasn't it. It's exactly what they were used to. And then, you know, I in the reporting of the book, I scored faster on a reflex test than Albert Pujols did.
Wow.
You know, but that's not saying that much, because he was in the 66th percentile compared to a bunch of college students. So it wasn't like he was off the charts.
Yeah.
And just to learn that, you know, through scientific studies that remove certain perceptual information from those hitters, you can drill down to figure out what sort of information they need to do what they do. And it turns out that it's learned perceptual expertise, the rotation of a pitcher's shoulder, the flicker of the ball, just the flashing pattern the seams make when the ball rotates, that allow them to really basically predict the future and do things that are far too quick for them to accomplish if they rely on their reflex. So that was something that I thought would be based on sort of inborn reflexes. It turns out to be very much the result of learned expertise.
And when you talk about removing those stimuli, you're talking about when they literally paint over the seams, the red seams of the baseball, and make them white.
They can't hit the ball.
Well,
there is also hardware you must have, as you describe, to hit those kind of balls, and that's way better vision than 20/20.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, the average for major league hitters is 20/12, which means they can see from 20 feet away what I have to stand at 12 feet away to see.
Yeah, and well, guess what, dude? I had 2015 and I sucked at hitting because I was afraid of the ball.
So they do have that hardware that's fairly rare and in all sorts of visual hardware. One of the studies that I thought was the coolest that I came across was this one in like some of the northern European countries, there are these amazing public health databases. So they can get huge numbers of people into studies. And one of these studies...
Socialism.
Hey, Hunter, we're libertarians on
yeah,
this.
Yeah, we're libertarians.
Keep going.
So women were sort of picked out of a database based on their depth perception, so they didn't even know why they were being chosen. And some women with poor depth perception and some with good depth perception were chosen. Then they were trained in basically catching skill, trying to catch balls moving at certain speeds. And their depth perception didn't really matter when the ball was going really slow, but it mattered a ton when the ball was going fast. The women with poor depth perception just basically didn't learn the skill when the ball was going faster. Hmm. So it's this interesting interaction of their hardware with their ability to learn the skill they would need for a sport.
Well, I loved, and you know, but part of what you capture, and I read some of this in Josh Waitzkin's book, The Art of Learning. I don't know if you've read it, but one of the things that I thought was very interesting, and this applies to chess masters, this applies to baseball players and other things, is that you, through thousands of hours of practice, you do a good job of debunking the 10,000 hours, because some people it could take 25,000 hours, some people 4,000 hours, but through the thousands of hours of practice, you begin to, the brain in a blink of an eye begins to chunk information. Yeah. You just can read patterns. A tennis player can see just based on the guy's body whether the ball's coming to his right beforehand or his backhand.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like, you know, I've been doing comedy for a long time, and I walked into a room and I saw a guy doing stand-up. I swear to God, I walked 3 seconds and I had to run out of the room. And my friend goes, "What are you doing?" I go, "That guy's terrible." He goes, "You didn't even hear anything." I go, "Dude, I could hear the music. I could hear the music in his voice and the rhythm. And I know all his influences, and I know that he's completely derivative, and I want to die." And I'm right, by the way, you know. I'm able to chunk
shitty
comments.
You're picking up on those perceptual cues. I mean, so you said 3 seconds, right? Three seconds is what grandmaster chess players often needed to recreate an entire chessboard if it was a meaningful position. If they were given a chessboard and the positions weren't meaningful, you know, that would be like, if I give you 20 random words right now, you're going to have trouble repeating them back to me. If I give you a 20-word sentence, you might be able to repeat that back to me, or at least you'll do a lot better because you've learned a system that relates those words to one another, so you're not remembering 20 pieces of disparate information. And I'm sure, doing what you do, you've picked up all sorts of cues that allow you to make judgments, some of which you probably don't even know exactly what they are.
No, I don't. I can do that. I can do that with girls too. Is she a complete freak? Let's move in that direction. But then I got married because I realized that's a bad idea.
Do we still refer to that as chunking, Brian?
Yeah,
deal with multiple girls at one time in order to figure that out.
I call it chunking, bro. When I was a young man, I had to start ignoring those instincts. I was like, "Oh, I'm being drawn that direction. That girl's got track marks. Move over here, man. She's go to the girl with the good family."
Well, I'm shocked there's not a wealth of scientific literature on that aspect.
There should be, bro. I'll be your test subject.
There is. It's all studied at the Hefner Institute.
You know what, man? Joe Rogan, in fact, is really good. We talk about this on his podcast. He's really good at looking at somebody really quickly, and you have to be careful with this, but he better than anybody I've ever met, is so good at looking at somebody and going, "That person's crazy," or "I got to get away from that person," or "They're lying." And I think it comes from the fact that as a kid, he came up in a very kind of unstable background. The world was a dangerous place for him, so he had to learn very quickly how to read people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that much about his personal background, but I've watched his commentary, you know, his mixed martial arts commentary for years, and I can tell you sometimes, like, he'll be commentating on something, and then I'm like DVRing it and putting in slow-mo, and I'm like, "Well, yeah, he was right."
He'll
pick up on stuff that he clearly has. He's picking up on, you know, the perceptual cues that an expert would pick up on that a lot of people miss.
Yeah.
But that's the power of learning. And I mean, I think that's the interesting thing too, is that, you know, at the beginning of the book, you talk about, we tend to think as sort of lay people that, oh, you have this gene, therefore it will all be easy for you. But so much of it is really quite complex, right? It's nature and nurture, but that's not how we tend to think. We tend to think, oh, there's a gene that's going to enable me to become, you know, LeBron James or whatever it is, right?
That's right, and it's really kind of unfortunate because, look, genes evolve and mutate in environments and in response to environments and things that we do, not sort of in some vacuum, and that's completely not the case. And one thing that I sort of wonder if I should have changed in the book that I get asked about a lot in Chapter 14, where I talk about genetics involved in the compulsive drive to train or be physically active, I quote a researcher who studies that, saying, like, there absolutely are couch potato genes.
Yeah, I love that. I love that, by the way. That one woman who who basically can't stop running. I read an article about her before, and then there are other people that just, you know, like my dad, who just getting him to work out has always been, he's just way more sedentary. My sister, for example, is way more sedentary than I am. I'm kinetic and good looking, but that's not part of it. So I had to throw that in there.
But those two are not necessarily,
I have the hardware for sex.
Yeah.
That woman that you mentioned, Pam Reed, the legendary ultramarathoner, that was one of my favorite interviews in the book, because the day I interviewed her, the previous day she had run the National Ironman Triathlon Championships in New York. She qualified for Worlds. And the next day she's flying out of LaGuardia, and her flight's delayed because it's LaGuardia, and she gets so antsy. She stashed her bags in a corner. She's running laps around the parking structure while I'm interviewing her.
Wow, what? While you're interviewing her?
Yeah, that's obviously an extreme case, you know, that's in that chapter where I quote the scientists saying they're couch potato genes, and a lot of interviewers have asked me, you know, well, so I guess I've got an excuse for saying the couch. I'm like, that's not what I was hoping the takeaway would be.
Right.
Will you have to manipulate your environment more than somebody else who's naturally active? Maybe, but then that's what you have to do. It doesn't mean that you can't get off the couch. It means you might have to work harder to create an environment that's conducive to the outcome.
Well, but one of the things that I really like about the book, though, is the fact that you are very the fact of the matter is you do have to have a certain hardware, a certain genetic structure, or you are never going to be world class.
But Brian, I think this is also our focuses here are clearly coming out of our own psychological journeys. For me, there was never any desire to be a great athlete. Whereas I think part of it is that for people who
you mean like me,
like
where
you,
all I wanted to be was the greatest wrestler of all time.
And that there's a certain amount of relief that comes from that, right?
Wrestling's a good example of a sport that when you're really tenacious and stuff, it actually can, and technique and stuff and good coaching can actually really compensate for a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't think at the world level or anything, but you know, there are sports where,
right,
you know, you can have a very satisfying athletic experience. But mm-hmm. I just wish I had been told that, Brian, you're not going to be, I couldn't figure out why I couldn't high jump, for example, or sprint, mm-hmm. but I kind of figured it out in my own way. I was like, I'm just not that bouncy.
The thing is, you know, what sort of pains me about it is when we have, obviously football, you know, is the most popular sport for high school boys here now. And like every time I go to a high school football game, there's 80 kids on the sideline. I see a dozen kids who aren't playing a single minute, and I'm looking at like their lower legs. And I'm like, you know what, you might have fun being on the track team.
Yeah, or exactly. Exactly.
When you look at, you know, Australia when they were awarded the Olympics, China when they were awarded the Olympics, Great Britain, 7 years out, they start these talent identification programs, usually based on things like aerobic capacity testing and body type measurements.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And they focus not on they don't focus on the 100 meters because that's globally competitive and very difficult. They focus on sort of the minor sports that aren't quite as globally competitive. And it works like crazy. They take people from one sport and they say, you know what, you're all right at throwing the javelin, but why don't we put you over in this other sport? You might be mm-hmm. a major.
But okay, Americans love the story about the underdog. I mean, look, Dennis Rodman, as you describe in the book, at 5'9" in high school, really didn't start playing basketball until he was 21. He's now a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
We love hanging every example on that. Everybody believes in their heart. The part of the American character mm-hmm. is that I am Dennis Rodman. I'm the underdog. I mean, think about our mythology. Think about every movie that does well. The Blind Side. Wasn't that?
Absolutely.
I mean, there's so many movies like that, especially sports movies. Rudy, the little guy does it. The guy, the bench warmer comes up and, you know, the Bad News Bears, for God's sake, right? So
yeah, but the Bad News Bears lose.
Whatever.
Rudy,
Hunter.
You know, and as cool as Rudy is, obviously that's a movie because he's an exception, right? And so it's great because he basically gets in on like one play where I'm like, you know what, this guy had some traits, both psychological and maybe physical, that maybe he could have actually been good in another sport instead of just like mm-hmm. fighting to get into one play for Notre
God,
Dame.
God, that's so true.
Well, but I mean, you know, just from a movie standpoint, that's also what Rocky does so well. You know, they frame the victory in the right way so that it's not about him winning. It's about like, I just want to last.
Well, the effort. But there are, I mean, look, man, I know people who've been doing stand-up for 15 years. Never made me laugh once. All right?
That's actually really sad. Depressing.
Yeah. It's like, bro, here's the note. Quit. And somebody should have told him that a long time ago, but you don't want to do that.
But do you think that that's, I mean, that's...
That's a bad example, because there are a lot of guys who start out and then they end up really funny. I mean.
But that's the point also. I mean, it's also, because I think that's what's maybe not talked about as much, is that there's obviously the physical practice that we see in a sport, right? We see a guy out there and, you know, they're hitting balls or, you know, in Brian's case in terms of boxing, hitting mitts. Let's not
overemphasize the fact that I'm not really a boxer, but I like the example. I like my shirt off, bandana. Keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's so much of this is the mental practice. Like, how are people thinking about these things? How are they breaking them down, right? Because not all practice mentally is created equal, you know? Yeah. Are you really focused on finding those patterns? Are you really focused on the right aspect? Are you focused on the seams? I mean, you could imagine two baseball players. One is looking at the seams. One is looking at the wide of the ball or something.
Absolutely. I mean, I saw some... In the reporting of the book, I talk about the Groningen talent studies a little bit, which is where these kids who go on to become pro soccer players and those who go on to become sort of not quite pro soccer players mm-hmm. are tracked from the age of 12 in the Netherlands. Yep. And the Netherlands is a great soccer country. I mean, they were in the World Cup final last time around. And one of the amazing things in the video you see is, like, from the age of 12, a lot of the kids who go on to become elite. So first of all, they're a little faster on average mm-hmm. in the shuttle run, and they always are, and that's that. But they also, you see them in the video, they're like the ones that are annoying the coaches. If they're doing some drill that they can already do really easily, they're like, why am I doing this? I mm-hmm. can already do this. Wow. Why don't I work on something that's going to improve what I can't, you know, do already? And the coach is kind of like, go over there, you know. But yeah. those are like the kids that are taking accountability.
Isn't that in some ways a genetic thing too? I mean, isn't that a personality type?
I read through a lot of behavioral genetics work, and I sort of shied away from getting into some of it sometimes because it didn't repeat well. But, like, there was always, I mean, I think the influences of genetics on behavior, you know, there are these amazing studies that seem to suggest that people, like, major personality traits are sort of indicated from, like, first grade, you know, early on.
To come at this from an Ed point of view, I mean, Carol Dweck, who's at Stanford, she's spent her whole career studying mindset, and specifically she studies two mindsets. One is a growth mindset, which is essentially you believe your intelligence can always grow and always improve, and the other one is a fixed mindset, where you believe your intelligence is static, and no matter what you do, you'll never get better. So that's people saying, I didn't get the math gene, I don't have a natural ear for languages and all of that sort of stuff. And firstly, you can definitely shift between those mindsets. Right. That's the first thing.
Hunter wrote a book called The Straight Edge Conspiracy about this, and it's a great book. He just had a signing at Barnes & Noble. Congratulations, by
the way. Which we sold every copy of the book
in
the store.
It's a damn good book.
The point is that, you know, that sort of behavior that you're talking about where these kids are really being very active about their practice, that's a real reflection of a growth mindset. And that's something that can absolutely be acquired and can change.
Sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, no. And I mean, and that's also something that's very domain specific. I mean, that's what we always think is so funny is that, you know, we work with kids who in math have a very fixed mindset and they won't as soon as they run into any problem, they'll give up and they'll quit. Mm. But then you see that same kid play a video game and you could not see a more growth mindset focused kid
where
they're like, they die, they get back up, they'll stick at the problem for 8-10 hours in a row. They won't even pee to fix, you know what I mean?
That's like, very interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, that mindset is something that can be acquired. And I know one of the things that Brian and I have talked about is the Kalenjin tribe in Kenya.
Yeah. Talk about that, David.
Yeah, that tribe. And speaking of that mindset, by the way, one thing that's funny is, like, so I guess I became sort of this, like, spokesman for genetic talent or something because, like, the conversation had been kind of unbalanced. But I'm like, you know, my friends and training partners know me as a guy who thinks training is, like, a miracle. You know, I think I can train anybody to run a marathon in 6 months. Not in 2:10, but really I think basically anybody who has healthy working legs. But the Kalenjin, so that's that tribe in this minority tribe in the Western Rift Valley province of Kenya that basically accounts for all of the runners that we say. So when we Americans say, wow, Kenyans are great marathoners, Kenyans say, wow, Kalenjin are great marathoners.
That's one area.
Yeah, and it's about 5 million people, you know, and they've just had in the two major marathons that have occurred this season so far, Berlin and Chicago, the top five men, including the new world record holder in Berlin, were Kalenjin. 1, 2, and 4 for the women were Kalenjin.
Wow.
In Chicago, 1 through 4 men were Kalenjin, and the winner, woman was Kalenjin. And that's from a source population the size of Costa Rica, and I can't even imagine if Costa Ricans had taken those places.
Yeah, and it bears mentioning that it's not as though they have some secret training technique. There are a lot of people training just as hard and just as long, right?
That's right. No, and also, you know, and they run to school a lot, which I think primes them for training, but so do millions of kids across Kenya that aren't Kalenjin.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing actually that you just made me think about, Hunter, about the growth mindset is, so the guy who just won Chicago, Dennis Cometto, was a farmer through 2010. He wasn't running at all.
Crazy.
He was growing maize and cows. But one thing that is amazing with the mindset of some of the Kalenjin runners is he didn't say like, well, you know, I'm basically past my physical prime. I can't really start training. So many of the Kalenjin runners that end up being world beaters will say like, okay, I'm going to start training today. And if I have talent, like, I'm going to win a major marathon within 2 years.
That's crazy. Yeah, it's a mindset. Yeah.
Like, I'd go to the track where they do intervals, and some guy would, like, park the taxi he drives and decide to just jump in an interval with a gold medalist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when Americans start running, they start as joggers, you know?
Yeah.
And they never plan to become world-class if they weren't good from early on. So I really think one amazing thing that sort of fosters what's going on in Kalenjin country is the idea that people say, well, you know, if I have talent, I'm going to train and it's going to be realized. They don't sort of say, well, it's too late for me.
Yeah. Well, and the you know, obviously the Kalenjin, they have whatever's going on with them. But I know that you're friends with Daniel Coyle, who wrote The Talent Code, which is also an excellent book.
Yeah.
And, you know, there what you find is there are a lot of these talent clusters. So, you know, Anna Kournikova comes along. She proves that a young Russian girl can become a world-class tennis player. And suddenly there's this explosion of Russian female tennis talent.
That's the Roger Bannister phenomenon.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know. Yep. I mean, so many of the barriers that have to be broken are psychological, you know, and once you see someone like me do something, then you believe that I can do it too.
Absolutely.
Right? Korean women are probably not preternaturally good at golf, right?
No.
But they have come to really dominate the sport.
Absolutely. No, and I think to some degree that the sports, I think it's more difficult sort of in sports like in the 100 meters, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it can be sort of more difficult because they're pretty strict physiological restrictions and things like that. But
you're not winning. let me be less politically correct. You ain't winning the Olympics or the world's in sprinting unless you have a West African background.
Every man who's been in an Olympic 100 meter final since the boycotted games of 1980, whether his homeland is Portugal, Netherlands, U.S., Canada, Jamaica, whatever. They all descend from actually a pretty small area on the coast of West Africa.
Is that right? What is the area?
And it's the Bight of Biafra. The area, and
which is I think Nigeria.
It's part of Nigeria tried to separate from Nigeria in the 1970s, and then had its ass whooped.
So that one area, that one area.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so
which by the way, was where most of the slaving happened. A large number of the slaves that were brought over to places like Jamaica came from the Bight of Biafra.
And even so, there are many more people of those origins in the United States than are in Jamaica, and Jamaica's still kicking our butt and sprinting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that's really, you know, you have a group of people who, you know, on average, if you search this population for sprint talent, you're going to find, you know, maybe more than you would elsewhere. But also, I mean, in what other country in the world would a guy who's 6'4", 15-year-old with blinding speed who would rather be a soccer player end up as a track runner? Because that's who Usain Bolt was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think there are many others of him out there.
Mm-hmm.
Unless he's born in Trinidad, the Bahamas, or Jamaica, he's not going to be identified.
Well, talk about that a little bit. I remember you said that the British slave owners talked about this one particular tribe from Ghana as born heroes. They were just a warlike group.
Yeah,
very, very athletic. Was that part of the from Biafra? Were they from Biafra, or was that?
Yeah,
was more...
yeah, the Coromanti, and they sort of produced these military leaders in Jamaica who kind of led a slave rebellion of a group called the Maroons who beat back the British military and won their freedom 100 years before official emancipation. And they sort of set up their home in the northwest area of Jamaica. Where there's this area called the Cockpit Country that's like made it really easy for them to defend because they knew the terrain really well, and there are all these sinkholes and cliffs and things. And that's now where many of the great sprinters come from. Usain Bolt, Veronica Campbell-Brown are kind of the best sprinters of a generation. And so there's the story I was told by Jamaicans is that, well, you know, it's these warriors who gave rise to our current sprint generation. But and it's really, really interesting, although so far the preliminary DNA data doesn't really show them to be like any sort of isolated population.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So that's also cultural factors perhaps coming in on top of a genetic background. Yeah.
Yep.
When you look at Michael Jordan, when you look at Pele, when you look at Muhammad Ali, when you look at LeBron James, I'm taking extreme examples of these phenomenal athletes. And not all necessarily. I don't know how much of Muhammad Ali's body was fast twitch versus a mixture because he had to fight 15 rounds and had to have a lot of endurance as well.
Yeah.
Where do you think, if you had to guess, where do you think these extreme athletes, primarily African-American, all African-American, where do you think they came from?
Generally? You mean in terms of their ancestry?
Well, because Michael Jordan clearly looks like a Maasai warrior.
Yeah.
LeBron James looks like he's a mixture of Nigerian and Sudanese.
Yeah,
but they're two different parts of Africa. I mean, is that just a genetic aberration to begin with? Obviously,
I mean, just first of all, yeah, they're outliers by any measure. But also, and Jordan's an outlier even in his own family. If you ever see a picture of him with his family,
it's crazy.
He's like 8 inches taller than everybody else.
He's basically the chosen one. God is like, God was like, you are the. He's the chosen one.
But yeah, I mean, and just having looked through the studies in one particular sort of seminal study by Sarah Tishkoff about the genetic backgrounds of African Americans, really interesting because there's sort of some specific, like African Americans in South Carolina are more genetically linked to the grain coast in Africa because the slave owners who wanted them for certain types of tasks, they wanted them to already know certain grain related tasks and things like that. But it's basically all West African. So I wouldn't expect any Maasai or Sudanese to be really mixed in for the most part at all until very recently.
Yeah, having said that, you're talking about some great athletes on the East Coast of Africa. And by the way, if everybody, people listening, this can be very kind of touchy subject, but you have a chapter in your book that says we are all Africans. The fact of the matter is geneticists have basically come to the conclusion that everybody on the globe came from Africa at one point or another, an area of East Africa, I think in the Congo. Am I right about that?
Yeah, and in fact, because our ancestors were in Africa and our even, primates that we evolved from were in Africa so much longer than we've been outside of Africa, and then it was just a tiny group of our ancestors who then left Africa and they only brought a little bit of the genetic diversity with them.
Wait a minute, you're saying the Garden of Eden did not happen? Why is this man on my podcast?
Don't blame me for ruining the story.
Sorry.
But, so if you basically got rid of, like if you wiped out the world's population other than sub-Saharan Africa, you would still preserve most of the genetic diversity on the globe.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You would lose certain things. Obviously, you would lose the genes that code for white skin and blonde hair, for example.
Right.
But you would preserve most of the people who are lactose tolerant, for example. But you would preserve most of the genetic diversity.
What a loss. Yeah, you would lose most of the people who are lactose intolerant.
And what would we do without them?
No, lactose tolerant, not intolerant. Right?
And so, that's really most of the genetic diversity is still in Africa. One of the things that section of the book you talk about is where I sort of take a detour from sports to talk about what race is and isn't genetically.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope to sort of emphasize there that while we often refer to black athletes as dominating, while the Africans in East Africa who dominate distance running and those in West Africa who are overrepresented in sprint and explosion sports share certain characteristics that come from low latitude ancestry, like dark skin, long proportional legs, in many ways they could not be more physiologically distinct.
Right.
So it's really like a coarse measure to just say, well, black.
Of course. I mean, an Ethiopian looks completely different than a Nigerian than does someone in the Sudan. Like,
right.
I mean, come on. It's really true. And by the way, there's also something called North Africa, which is where there are a lot of Arabs. So,
yeah. And Berbers. The Tuareg.
Yeah.
The other thing, I mean, the section in your book that I was most blown away by was the section on gender.
Mind-blowing. Yes.
Utterly mind-blowing.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Then let me just, for the people who haven't read the book, you basically talk about how a lot of very good female athletes don't have uteruses and actually have
internal
testes. They have an XY chromosome.
Yeah, they have a Y. I got to tell you also, as an aside, if I had thought, I mean, I was like getting my resume ready when this book was coming out. If I thought I was going to be talking about like race and gender, like in the media, and that it was going to go anything but really, really poorly, it's totally still a surprise.
Of course,
yes. Yeah.
So this condition of where someone is chromosomally male, has XY chromosomes, but for other reasons does not respond to testosterone at a certain point in development in the womb, they will continue to develop as female. And in fact, if they can't respond to testosterone at all, they'll be sort of hyper female, like no body hair, very feminine.
Wow.
And
that's so hot.
So that's normally about like a 1 in 50,000 births occurrence, but it's about 1 in 400 female Olympians.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really overrepresented. And the thinking is that it's probably because those women end up significantly taller on average.
And not just that, it's also the limb length as well, right?
And the limb length. They have limb length, so longer proportional limbs, which is more typical of growth patterns of male.
Yes, but also women have better reaction. I mean, men have better reaction time from what I know that from fighting. I mean, I don't know. Hasn't that been proven?
I don't remember seeing better reaction times for men, and women always outperform men on fine motor skills. I'd have to go back and look at the reaction time data, but usually if it's like simple reaction time, just hitting a button in response to a light, 200 milliseconds.
I'm talking about moving out of a punch. Seeing a punch, moving out of the way. That's what I'm talking about. Reaction to that.
I see. Yeah. I don't know for sure, but since a lot of that is based on perceptual skill, I would assume that a lot of it would, for any individual, would be determined by how much actually they've practiced that particular
skill. And then there is one other profession that is where intersex people are overrepresented, and that is...
That is modeling, and that's...
Dude, just stop it right now.
So what you're saying is that there are many of these models, the reason why they have really long, attractive legs is because they have balls on the inside.
Because they have male chromosomes. And the only way I learned this is when I was talking to a lot of endocrinologists, about particularly those who treat elite athletes, and they would tell me, well, yes, I have patients, women, female athletes who have XY chromosomes, but they're insensitive to testosterone. Or I have women with this other condition called partial hydroxylase deficiency, which causes an increased production of testosterone. And sometimes the women will want to get that treated for cosmetic reasons. Sometimes, like, they'll have acne and things like that.
Yeah.
And
this mm-hmm.
one endocrinologist I talked to treats a lot of American gold medalists would say that he would tell them, like, trust me, you don't want that treated until your competitive days are over.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Because you're gonna lose muscle mass and stuff like that.
Yeah, and for the models, if they are XY chromosomes and androgen insensitive, they tend to be taller on average. They tend to have like very little or no body hair, longer proportional limbs on average, and so those are the kind of things that are conducive.
Men generally find attractive. Yeah.
I'm partial to very curvy Latin, Italian, Jewish. I like all women. I don't have a type. I just like.
But
go on.
But that was pretty mind blowing. It actually reminded me. I don't know if you ever saw that episode of House where they have this incredibly attractive like teenage model, and they can't figure out what is wrong with her, and then they figure out she has testicular cancer. Her internal testes have cancer.
That's
and
so
that she's
weird.
Actually a man. But I mean, I in terms of this, I thought that you told the story of, I think it was the Spanish hurdler.
Uh-huh.
I mean, would you mind telling that story? Because, I mean, that's just so devastating, so heartbreaking.
Yeah, that was Maria Martinez Jose Patino, who was a national champion hurdler in Spain and in the 1980s. And she went to a competition one time, and she forgot this sort of ID card that female athletes had to bring at the time that said that they were women. And, they had basically just been examined visually, like dropped their pants in front of a doctor kind of thing.
And I think the only woman who was exempted from that was Princess Anne at some point. I remember she competed, I think, in show jumping or some utterly ridiculous sport.
Right.
And they were like, oh, you're a princess. You don't have to drop your
pants.
You don't
pants. Have to show us.
Your hoo-ha.
I didn't even know that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true, but I heard that. That may
I
be
like
an urban
it.
Legend.
She's,
yeah.
she's a princess, everyone. Of course she has perfect labia.
So this hurdler, so between the time that she had gotten that ID card, they had started doing chromosomal testing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this time around, she had to go for chromosomal testing, and, they basically give her the news, say, sorry, you're a man. You have XY chromosomes.
Jesus.
And she had, having never heard this before. And
wow.
Some of the governing officials for the Spanish Federation start telling her, like, just fake an injury and retire, and, like, everything will be fine. She's like, no way, she's not going to retire. She's the best hurdler in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so she goes forward. She wins the national championship, and the information gets leaked to the press, and she's sort of ridiculed, and her fiancé leaves her, and her financial support is all withdrawn, these sorts of things. And a geneticist, in another country sort of saw this, and he was expert in the condition that she had, and said, hey, this woman can't respond to testosterone at all. Like, she's not at any advantage here. This
mm-hmm.
is not fair. Human biology doesn't break down as cleanly as you governing officials wish it would.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of helped her, and she stood up and fought the case, whereas other female athletes had just did sort of quietly retire.
Slinked away, yeah.
Came up. And she ended up being reinstated, but it was sort of after the prime of her career. But
mm-hmm.
now that kind of biological sex testing, there's recognition that there's no you know, for some people, chromosomes and genes and genitalia and all those things don't necessarily match. And mm-hmm. so now universal sex testing is gone from Olympic sports, although there's still some situations that get pretty controversial, like with Caster Semenya.
Who is pretty... Have you ever seen Caster Semenya? You should look her up.
Really?
I mean,
why?
Yeah,
why?
Well, it's if you... I mean, she does look pretty manly.
Yeah. Very narrow hips, like totally shredded.
I mean, and
very
so
deep voice.
Would that basically be... how do you spell it?
C-A-S-T-E-R.
Because I, you know, I want to talk to you about... What's the last name?
Semenya. S-E-M.
Yeah.
E-N-Y-A, I think.
And she sort of came out of nowhere a couple of years ago and just, like, basically, like, looked over her shoulder in the World Championships final, the 800 meters, and just, like, ran away from the entire field. And that's when the ruckus started.
Yeah, well, that's I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but that's a handsome young man. And God bless her, but that's crazy. Yeah, but this is where we're headed in... It raises very important questions. I was going to do a movie. I was going to do a movie, and I had to put on muscle, the director told me. And I said, that's crazy. I'm looking at these pictures. But I stop laughing, Hunter. She does look very male.
But, the thing is, people like her get, like, accused of cheating, though, you know? It's like,
And it's because she has an XY chromosome, right?
Yeah, but
I mean, is that what it is?
We don't know. It's been reported that she does have that condition and that she had elevated testosterone and that she had internal testes. She never sort of responded to it publicly, but
It is what it is, man. You know, but this raised a very important question to me. Is that I was going to do, I had to put on some muscle and, this trainer I work with is a bodybuilder, and he said, I said, hey, dude, I want to put on 10 pounds of muscle. I got like 3 months. And he goes, oh, do you? I go, yeah. He goes, and how do you expect to do that? I go, I don't know. I'll just eat more and lift heavy. He goes, you do lift heavy. I lift you heavy. I go, I know, but what do I got to do? He goes, hey, bro, you're a coat hanger. Genetically, I'm all right. I'm pretty athletic. But he goes, if you want to put on that much muscle in 3 months or whatever you're telling me, I got to change your endocrine system. Okay. And I wanted to ask you about steroids and
Super Baby
and human. Yeah. Yeah.
And well, about that's the, Super Baby.
That's the myostatin stuff. But I want to talk to you about what your take is on steroids, human growth hormone. Everybody that I know who's an athlete has taken it or does take it. And second of all, he wants me to take Caster Semenya off. You're so immature, dude. But talk a little bit about, first of all, what's your take on steroids, on whether or not they're safe, and more importantly, as we develop these techniques to block myostatin in the muscles and gene dope and stuff, where is sport headed? It's no longer so much going to be about just training and competition. The more we learn about genetics, I mean, frankly, when I read your book and the kind of research that people like you do, it takes the magic of sport away from me a little bit, because if hardware plays such an important factor, and it does. Yes, I know training is very important, but technology is going to outpace our biology, already is. We are going to get to a point where we are going to gene dope and do all kinds of things that are going to make us preternaturally fast, be able to run forever, et cetera, et cetera. What is your take on the future of this, and where are we headed?
So those were a bunch of questions. So let me go through the ones
I'm not a good interviewer, dude. I'm not a good interviewer. I like to shotgun my guests.
In terms of the magic of sport, let me start with that one really quick. Because I've gotten that question a lot, and I totally understand that. But for people have sort of said, well, it's not a level playing field, so isn't that like no fun? And I sort of don't think people ever thought that it was a level playing field, or else we would just have identical twins.
Sure, physical inequality is a fact. Anybody who's ever done sports knows that, right? I mean,
right. Yeah. And I think sort of that people seized on, as Malcolm Gladwell sort of wrote that article where he mentioned my book and Daniel Coyle and Tyler Hamilton's book, The Secret Race, and sort of says, like, well, genes are unequal, so does that mean doping is just leveling the playing field? And my opinion is that you can argue about what the rules should be, but that sports is about standardizing the rules, not the genes.
That's right.
That people compete against. But and for me, I view sports as like this, just the awesomest stage to examine human biological diversity. And so I really enjoy that, digging into it. So it doesn't take away the magic for me at all, or like the fact that Michael Jordan's 6'6" to me doesn't diminish the hard work that he put in, even though that's taller than like 99% of humanity.
Yeah, no doubt.
And to go to the back to that underdog story, I mean, he was cut from his high school basketball team. Like, it clearly took him a lot of hard work.
He was also a freak. But let me ask you this: what percentage, before you go on with the questions, what percentage of Americans are 6'3" and over?
Let's see, 68% are just in the 6 foot range, from 5'7" to 6'1". 6'3" and over, it's really small.
It's like 3.5%.
It's like 3.3 or 3.4, something like that. Yeah, it's like 3%.
Amazing.
Like
anyway.
I'm
sorry. So
steroids. So I think your question was how dangerous do I think they are?
Yeah.
I think that it depends on the steroid. So, like, one of the worst, the supplement craze just got called out for having methasterone in it, I think it was. And that's, like, one of the worst steroids, methasterone, which is, there's, like, case studies of guys having, like, real liver damage with just a couple months' use. And I think it depends on the steroid. Because steroids are testosterone analogs, and they're engineered to increase the anabolic effect, and you hope you have less of the androgenic effect. I think steroids in general are far more dangerous than just taking testosterone, which I think if you just take the testosterone and it's managed well, I think you can really minimize a lot of the risks.
Steroids are really actually something that gets your body to produce more testosterone.
The steroids usually are chemical analogs themselves of testosterone.
Okay.
So they will cause your body to, so a hormone binds to its receptor and then it triggers all these other effects. And the steroid will do the same thing. It has that same sort of basic chemical structure as testosterone. But from my reading of the medical literature, you're better off taking the testosterone directly. It might not be quite as powerful itself.
Right.
You get up the dosage. But some people will have side effects for sure. But I think that, like, the congressional baseball hearings, they way overblow the side effects of someone who's using it in a monitored way. And now there are huge numbers of people who are doing that, and some of them will have side effects that they might not like, because all medications have side effects. But I think the sort of fear and loathing is far, far beyond where it should be. And that, in fact, it's kind of stigmatized testosterone in a way that causes some people who probably should be using it not to want to use it.
What about human growth?
Growth hormone, so because of a really sort of unfortunate fact of legal writing and ambiguous writing in the law that governs growth hormone, we don't know nearly as much about it as we should. What I'll say is it looks like short-term side effects are reversible when someone stops taking it, assuming that you don't have a tumor, because it might make that tumor grow like it makes everything else grow.
Scary.
That's
proven, that's a possibility?
That's a definite possibility, and there's some suggestive evidence. But there's also evidence in animals that it can help regrow cartilage, but we haven't done enough work on it because it's so restricted. So it's really unfortunate, because it seems like there could be all these potential good uses, and there doesn't seem to be, for someone who doesn't have a tumor, there doesn't seem to be any serious risk so far, again, from what I've seen, of like an acute use that might try to help somebody recover from surgery or something like that. So I would love to see serious study of those uses, so we can figure out what might be really useful about this drug that's sort of been demonized before we even know enough about it.
You're seeing a lot more biochemistry being brought into, testing these things. I mean, for example, the standard that's now used for testing gender, I believe, is the level of testosterone that the person is sensitive to.
Right.
The EPO has obviously been very big in cycling, right? Erythropoietin, which stimulates red blood cell production.
Right.
But there's obviously natural variability in that. And then, of course, there's Super Baby, right, who basically produces naturally twice as much muscle as a normal individual because of a genetic mutation.
Yeah, right.
So it's great to think that, we're all still going to be competing, but, we're having to draw these increasingly arbitrary lines between, you're in the same category and can fairly compete with each other. What do you think? Do you think we're going to start more and more segmenting, where there are going to be more and more categories, or do you think that we're just going to remain with males and females, and then, we decide what's male, what's female, we decide, and if you're lucky enough to have that genetic draw, then great.
I tend to think the latter. I think we're not going to see much more segmenting. I'm not positive about that, but I think where you see sort of the extreme of segmenting is like in the Paralympics, where there might be like 15 different versions of the 100-meter final. Because they're sort of trying to decide who has equivalent disabilities, even if they're different impairments. And I think as cool as I think a lot of the Paralympics are, I think that can be tough as a spectator because, like, you don't have a one champion kind of
thing. Absolutely.
But part of what was great about the Olympics is the fact that part of what we love about Usain Bolt is that he does have a machinery that makes him so special. We don't care about the genetics. We just love that he's the fastest man in the world. Of course he's got genetics and everything else. I mean, that's part of what makes the sport so fun to watch. There's an outlier. Wow, Michael Jordan, an outlier. We want to take pictures with a guy who's extraordinary. Who cares why, right?
And I think Bolt actually has sort of figured out, I think it's part of the genius of Bolt, like, it, the guy never runs in indoor. I don't think I've ever heard or seen of him running an indoor track race in my life, so he skips that entire season that somebody
really
competed in. Huh. You know, in between World Championships years, he's basically MIA. And I think here's a guy with a massive proportion of fast twitch muscle fibers who can generate incredible force. And the one period of his career where people were getting on his back about training more, he was injured all the time. And now, if you read his biography, he says sort of, I like my coach now because he knows sometimes I'm not going to show up for practice and sometimes I need to take it easy. And I think he's really sort of figured out the mentality that works for his physiology. So is he very gifted? Yes, he's very gifted. But I also think it's been put in the hands of a guy who is at a point where he says, I know what's right for my body, and I don't need to train the way that my training partner, Johan Blake, does. You know, when I talked to Johan Blake once, he said, if Usain Bolt's ever there, like when Blake is actually leaving practice, the coach will say, big man, what are you doing here? What's going on? Your car's broken? You know, yeah. But that's, for a guy like him, like, I went to Japan to watch sumo training as part of the reporting of the book, and these are guys who, it's a marathon if a bout lasts for 20 seconds. Right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
And they do one a day. And they're doing this training where they're pushing each other across the ring, like 100 intervals of it. I'm like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
All you're going to do is make your fast twitch fibers take on like some of the metabolic properties of slow twitch fibers. And then your bout's going to be 8 seconds. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, they're not training for their sport.
They're training hard, but they're training stupid.
That's tradition. That sumo's so steeped in tradition. And in fact, I'm sorry, but part of that's also one of the issues of Japanese culture when it comes to innovation and stuff. The idea of doing something that your teacher didn't do is rather taboo and can be considered even insulting to your teacher. So that's something that Japan has to confront eventually.
And I mean, I respected the discipline and the effort they were putting forth. You know, I just don't think it was the right.
Yeah, until you're running on a hamster wheel.
I respect that they eat chanko, which is perhaps the most disgusting looking gruel you've ever seen. It's basically a soup of floating fat chunks. That's,
is that right?
That's how they bulk up.
In that area, like around, there's like one area where a lot of the sort of training dojos are, and all the places are advertising.
Is that right?
It's utterly gross. Have you ever seen muktuk?
No.
Muktuk is this thing that they eat in Alaska, the indigenous people, and it's basically whale blubber mixed with seasonal berries.
Mm. Get your vitamin C here. Get your vitamin C and your fat here.
Yeah, utterly.
But you
gross.
Did some studies on the Iditarod and you know, the people who of the extreme northern climates who, you know, the body types, just different kinds of body types.
Yeah, I mean, the ideal body type, of course, is, you know, these are these two laws that sort of generally govern this, Allen's Law and Bergman's Law, which basically say that as you go farther north, and particularly as you get to cooler, more moist climates, body types will be, first of all, the limbs will be shorter compared to the body length. So long limbs are good for cooling, same reason that a radiator has long coils, to increase the surface area compared to the volume to let heat out. And so as you go north and you want to retain more heat, the bodies become wider and shorter limbs. Like, the ideal body shape at the North Pole would be a sphere because it retains a lot of its heat. And so those people gravitate toward becoming more spherical.
I've talked to Navy SEALs about the training. The hardest part is just dealing with the cold. And you either have, my other buddy is a tough dude, but he kept getting hypothermia. He just could not conserve heat. And he just didn't make it. He can do a pull up with literally he can put one finger on a bar and do a pull up. He's a freak athletically, but he just had too much fast twitch muscle. His body just he couldn't retain heat. He just couldn't. They stuck a thermometer up his ass and taped it to his leg, to monitor his internal body temperature because he just kept hypo. He called it hypoing out. He just couldn't deal with it. And some guys just don't get as cold. and they can deal with the training.
It's obviously not a lack of toughness on your friend's part.
No, it's just
he had a thermometer up his ass.
It's a question of how well you deal with, you know, the ability to conserve or get rid of heat. I mean, you know, that's kind of what it is. Where are we headed? What are the steroids of tomorrow? Where are we headed with technology? What should we expect to see? In other words, when can I look like Usain Bolt?
Whenever I think next week. No.
Okay. Good.
Whenever, amazingly, I would talk to a scientist who discovered a gene, you know, that basically you can alter and cause explosive muscle growth. They would be inundated by messages from athletes, like offering to be experimented on. And so I think there's no question that there's a willingness out there to do some of that. And part of the barrier has been, well, most traits are a complex network of genes, and we wouldn't even know how to engineer it even if we wanted to. But then there are those exceptions, like the myostatin gene, which, you know, altering it can cause explosive muscle growth, or the EPO receptor gene, like I write about in the last chapter, that can, you know, a version of which can cause somebody to really overproduce red blood cells. So there are single gene targets.
Right.
That could be altered to change someone's athleticism. And it's not, it shouldn't necessarily be all that difficult, not necessarily safe, but not all that difficult. And I think people are, or, you know, will be trying. I mean, there was actually evidence that a German track coach was trying to, or maybe did, get his hands on a gene therapy drug called Rupoxygen that causes an increase in red blood cells.
And this was a high school German track coach, right?
Yeah, I think he also coached above high school, but high school also.
Which is so bizarre.
Yeah, and so I think the willingness is there. One thing I think that will maybe keep it a little slower for now is that it's not necessarily safe, and also I think traditional methods of doping are really effective and so difficult to detect. Like, the reputation of anti-doping is far exceeds its actual capabilities. You know, the rate of false negatives is tremendous.
Right.
And so I think while that's working so well, most athletes might stick with that for now because it's sort of known and there's an easy pipeline and it works.
Good. David Epstein, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the book and how much we appreciate you taking the time. I think I emailed Hunter. I go, we got to get David Epstein on. And when you said yes, it was very exciting.
No, the pleasure is all mine. It's really neat to hear. Like, you know, I was sort of hoping to get people interested and fired up about exercise science and physiology, and just to hear, you know, you guys sort of engage with it, where you're obviously thinking about other disciplines, whether it's teaching or whatever, and thinking about your own sort of athletic experiences. I mean, that was my greatest hope. So,
well, it's very relevant to everything, it's a gutsy book too, so I commend you on that. It's not easy to write a book like this. Sometimes you get a lot of criticism where it's not deserved. So, you know, what is your next book? What can we look forward to?
I have no idea. You know, I mean, I really put my life like on hold to.
Sure.
I mean, I was like, you know, reading the Journal of Applied Physiology when, you know, every weekend and night and all that thing. Like, I'm looking forward to taking a vacation, like not to rural Kenya or to Arctic Finland in January. Those were great, but. Yeah, I'm not sure. I realize now, knowing sort of how much energy that took, I want to like be careful before I wade into a project like that again. But I'm open to suggestions, though.
I like it, man. Well, I can't wait personally to see what your next book is, man. You got a real gift for it. So, and
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, if I'm in New York, I'm gonna let you know. And
please do.
Beers on me, and come out to some stand up.
I'd love to.
All right, brother.
Some myostatin suppressing beer.
That's right. I think by the time we air this, I'm going to be in. We'll let you know when we air it too, David. And we're going to have your book on our website, of course, for people to get it. I recommend it highly to everybody. I'll be doing stand up in San Diego at the American Comedy Club November 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, and then I'll be in. I'll be at the Sacramento Punchline November 7th, 8th, and 9th. I can't wait. So there it is, ladies and gentlemen. David Epstein, you're a stud. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks for having me, and do let me know if you're in town. Seriously.
I will for sure, pal. I will for sure. Thank you, bro.
Thank you so much for the book.
Yeah, hey, my pleasure.
Awesome. All right.
My pleasure.
Later.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
He's great.
Awesome. And I think the other thing that's worth noting, too, is it's just such a fun read. Like, it's really fascinating. It's really well-paced.
Yeah.
It's a great, great read.
Yeah, I mean, people are always asking me what kind of books to read. That dude's book, that's a great place to start. It's just fascinating. I could not stop reading it.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I read the shit out of it. And I read the shit out of Merchants of Doubt. And it's just great, man. So it's a pleasure to do this podcast. I learned something, whether or not 6 people are listening or 1 million people. I love doing it.
Or 6 million.
And you're
people.
A big part of it, Hunter Monson.
No, I'm a part that's whispered right after your own name.
What are you
Brian?
Talking about? Hunter Monson, I don't know what you're talking about. All right. Because you're a whisper. All right, ladies and gentlemen.
The book whisperer.
There it is. Later.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.